This is Radio Democracy, a series of 12 commentaries by the noted author and political analyst Michael Parenti. This segment is titled Real Alternatives, a look at the false alternatives posed by the administration and practical solutions for fundamental changes in policies and priorities.
In February 1991, while attending the National Grocers Association, then-President Bush visited a model supermarket. When taken to the checkout counter and shown how to pass a couple of items over the scanner, Bush excitedly voiced his admiration for this, quote, new technology. It was evident that he had not visited a supermarket in years, if ever in his life. The incident is emblematic of the hidden class dimensions of our policy process. People who have never set foot in a supermarket and never have had to worry about a food budget make public policies for people who have to count every penny. Health policy is formulated by people who never have to sit for hours in a public clinic or go without medical care. Transportation policy is made by people who never waited for a bus or searched for a parking space. Our education system is legislated by people who have never had to send their children or grandchildren to public schools. Our daycare policy is devised by people who have au pairs and nannies to take care of their children. Public recreational policy is in the hands of people who vacation on their private country estates and have never visited a crowded, polluted municipal beach. And occupational safety laws are written by people who have never been inside a factory or have gone down into a mine. The ruling political economic elites maintain that low-income and unemployed people are doing well enough. They conveniently believe the environment is doing just fine, certainly on their estates and their vacation resorts and their ranches. They dislike what they think are the overheated jeremiads of environmentalists who call for regulations that limit the prerogatives of industrial capital. These elites equate the well-being of their class and their investments with the national interest, and they see the poor and the working multitudes as deserving of lesser consideration because they supposedly contribute so little. Among the recent undertakings by political economic elites are the North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, known as GATT, both of which represent attempts to circumvent the sovereignty of nation-states in favor of the transnational corporations. As presented to the public, NAFTA and GATT will break down tariff walls, they'll integrate national economies into a global system, and they'll benefit the people of all nations with increased trade. This globalization process is treated as a benign and inevitably historical development that supposedly has taken us from regional to national and now to international market relations. The goal of the transnational corporation is to be truly transnational, in fact. That is, the goal is to be above the sovereign power of any particular nation while being serviced by the sovereign powers of all nations. With GATT, the big business world in its entirety will be elevated above the sovereign powers of the various nation states. The GATT agreements create a World Trade Organization, which is an international association of over 120 signatory nations with the same legal status as the UN. This World Trade Organization has the authority to prevent, overrule, or dilute the environmental, social, consumer, and labor laws of any nation. It sets up panels composed of non-elected trade specialists who act as judges over economic issues, placing them beyond the reach of national sovereignty and popular control. In this way, it ensures that community interests will be subordinated to finance capital interests. Confirmed by no elective body, limited by no conflict of interest provisions, these world trade panelists can have financial stakes in the very issues they adjudicate. They meet in secret, do not publicize their proceedings, and are not subject to administrative appeal. Their function is to harmonize production standards in all nations, bringing them to an international lowest common denominator, one that is judged as least trade restrictive. GATT will create a world in which, more than ever, the major regulators are the transnational corporations themselves. GATT's 500 pages of rules do not regulate business, trade, and investment. Actually, they regulate governments. Signatory governments must lower tariffs, end farm subsidies, treat farm companies the same as domestic ones, honor all corporate patent claims, and obey the rulings of a permanent elite bureaucracy, the World Trade Organization. Should a country refuse to change its laws when a World Trade Panel so dictates, GATT can impose international trade sanctions, depriving the resistant country of needed markets and materials. GATT will work for strong nations at the expense of weaker ones and for rich interests at the expense of the rest of us. Under GATT, some countries have already argued that mandatory nutritional labeling on food products, the ban on asbestos, fuel economy and emission standards for cars, marine life protection laws, and the ban on dangerous pesticides all constitute unfair non-tariff trade barriers. In June 94, Ralph Nader noted that citizens acting at the local, state, and national levels have become something of a hindrance to corporations acting on the global level. The World Trade Organization would greatly reduce citizen involvement in matters of commerce, undermining present U.S. regulatory laws. Under GATT, also, U.S. workers will be forced to compete with child labor and slave labor in countries like Bangladesh, Indonesia, Thailand, and the like. The tariff protections that we have against the importation of goods from child slave labor would be considered a violation of GATT and would be removed. These are laws which were passed by the people of the United States. Generally, GATT will allow for the massive corporate acquisition of publicly owned property, the corporate acquisition of the holdings of local owners and worker collectives. Deprived of tariff protections, many small family farms in North America and Europe will go under, and the self-sufficient village agricultural economies of much of Asia and Africa will be destroyed. Third world peasant producers will be driven from the land by the millions, as is already happening in Mexico under NAFTA. We're told that to remain competitive under GATT, we're going to have to increase our productivity while reducing our labor and production costs. That's called speed up. We will have to spend less on social services and introduce more wage concessions, more restructuring, deregulation, and privatization. Only then might we cope with the impersonal forces sweeping us along, we are told. In fact, there's nothing impersonal about these forces. GATT was consciously planned by business and governmental elites over a period of years, by interests that have repeatedly and explicitly pursued a deregulated world economy and have opposed all democratic checks upon business practices. As capital becomes ever more mobile and unaccountable under plans like NAFTA and GATT, the people of any one province or state or nation will find it increasingly difficult to get their government to impose protective regulations or develop new forms of public sector production. Let me offer one instance. Under the free trade agreements between Canada and the United States, the single-payer auto insurance program adopted by the province of Ontario was declared unfair competition by U.S. insurance companies. The citizens of Ontario were not allowed to exercise their sovereign democratic power to institute an alternative not-for-profit insurance system, designed to leave the world's economic destiny to the tender mercy of bankers and multinational corporations. This so-called globalization is a logical extension of corporate imperialism, a victory of international finance over democratic self-determination. Over the last two decades, in Latin America, Asia, and even in Europe and North America, conservative forces have pushed hard to take publicly owned, not-for-profit industries and services, mines, factories, oil wells, banks, railroads, telephone companies, utilities, television systems, postal services, health care, insurance firms, many of these in many countries not-for-profit, and sell them off at bargain prices to private interests to be operated for profit. In a few countries like India, nationally oriented leaders attempted with some success to push out Western companies, exclude foreign investors from stock exchanges, build up the public sector, and create homemade consumer goods for local markets. India's economic links with the Soviet Union bolstered such efforts. But with the collapse of the USSR, the advent of GATT, and a newly installed conservative government, India is headed for recolonization. By the early 1900s in India, previously excluded Western companies like Coca-Cola have returned. Western investments are surging. Entire industries and consumer markets are once more completely under foreign control, and government-owned industries have been privatized against the protests of their employees and with inevitable cuts in wages and jobs. A similar process is taking place in other countries that were previously supported by the USSR. Today, the United States is the foremost antagonist of revolutionary change in the Third World. The exercise of U.S. power is intended to preserve not only the multinational corporate system, but the U.S. hegemony of that system. The Pentagon's Defense Planning Guidance Draft of 1992 urges the United States to continue to dominate the international system by, quote, discouraging the advanced industrial nations from challenging our leadership or even aspiring to a larger global or regional role, unquote. By maintaining this dominance, the Pentagon analysts assert the United States can ensure, quote, a market-oriented zone of peace and prosperity that encompasses more than two-thirds of the world's economy. This global power is immensely costly. Today, the United States spends more on military arms and other forms of national security than the rest of the world combined, diverting more and more capital and creativity from the civilian to the military sector. While other countries are free to invest in more economically productive things than we, because we're spending so much on the military. It's no mystery what needs to be done. The military spending binge of $4 trillion over the last 14 years is the major cause of our national debt, our decaying infrastructure, and our crushing tax burden. This military binge has transformed the U.S. from the world's biggest lender into the world's biggest spender and debtor. To save $1 trillion over the next decade, we should cut the bloated, wasteful defense budget by two-thirds within a few years. A good portion of our nuclear arsenal is directed against a country that no longer exists. To save billions every year and minimize the enormous damage done to the environment, the U.S. government should stop all nuclear tests, including underground ones, and wage a diplomatic offensive for a nuclear-free world. It could shut down almost all of its hundreds of military bases abroad and stop playing the self-appointed global guardian who monitors everyone else's behavior on behalf of the free market. We could eliminate the manned space program, a $30 billion boondoggle whose major contribution has been to wreak destruction upon the ozone layer. We could eliminate the elaborate and expensive missile defense systems that are being developed and maintained to defend us against a country that no longer exists, as I pointed out already. The depressive economic effects of ridding ourselves of a war economy could be mitigated by embarking upon a massive conversion to a peace economy, putting the money saved from the military budget into domestic needs. Millions of productive new jobs could be created if government invested these funds in human needs and municipal services, retraining displaced defense industry workers for more productive and more socially useful jobs. The shift away from war spending would greatly improve our quality of life and lead to a healthier overall economy. Congress should abolish the CIA or drastically cut its budget and that of other national security agencies. Their mandates should be limited to intelligence gathering. We should prohibit their subversive and violent covert actions against third world social movements. We should impeach those intelligence agency officers who failed to obey the lawful limits imposed on them and who continue to maintain links with organized crime. The power of the executive to act with criminally violent effect against various nations, including our own people, should be exposed, challenged, and stopped. The Freedom of Information Act should be enforced instead of undermined by those who say they have nothing to hide, then try to hide almost everything they do. We should end U.S.-sponsored counterinsurgency wars against the poor of the world. Eliminate all foreign aid to regimes engaged in human rights violations against their own peoples. Why should U.S. taxpayers be supporting torturers and death squads in other countries just to make the world safe for the Fortune 500? The billions of U.S. tax dollars that flow into the Swiss bank accounts of foreign autocrats could be better spent on human services at home. We should lift the trade and travel bans imposed on Cuba and other countries that have dared to deviate from the free market orthodoxy. There are other things that we could do. We could reintroduce the progressive income tax for rich individuals and corporations, and without the many loopholes and deductions that still exist. We could strengthen the inheritance tax and introduce a tax on accumulated wealth rather than just income. At the same time, we could give tax relief to the working poor and other low-income employees. We could reduce the regressive Social Security tax. It produces a yearly $50 billion surplus that is shifted into the general budget to be spent on all sorts of things other than pensions for the elderly. Or we could increase Social Security payments to low-income elderly so that the surplus is spent on the people for whom it is intended. Other things we could do is abolish the anti-labor laws like the Taft-Hartley that make it so difficult for people to organize into unions. In an earlier commentary, I pointed out that most Americans would like to be in unions. Unions are so weak because the laws are so rigged against them and it's so hard to organize. We could enforce government National Labor Relations Act protections on behalf of workers who now risk their jobs when they try to organize. We could penalize employers who refuse to negotiate a contract after certification has been won. We could repeal the restrictive right to work and open shop laws that undermine collective bargaining. We could increase the minimum wage to a living wage level. We could pass a law prohibiting the hiring of scabs, or so-called permanent replacement workers, during a strike. Legislation along these lines was promised by the Clinton administration, but never delivered. Clinton did nothing to push the bill that would have outlawed permanent replacements. He couldn't push it past a threatened Senate filibuster in July of 94. He does everything to get NAFTA and GATT passed, but very little to help labor. Americans are working harder and longer for less. In 1960, a college graduate with a mediocre academic record, let's say a C-minus record, could earn enough money to buy a three-bedroom house and a car and support a wife and three children, a full-time housewife and three children. Today, it takes two childless adults working full-time to achieve a commensurate standard of living. While millions are overworked, millions have no work at all. We should initiate a six-hour workday or a four-day work week with no pay cut and no compulsory overtime. And we should repeal the North American Free Trade Agreement, and we should repeal the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which place national sovereignty in the hands of non-elective, secretive international tribunals that can overrule the pro-labor, environmental, and consumer laws of state and federal governments. There are still other things we could do. None of these have been considered by Republican leaders or Democratic leaders, certainly not in the White House today. We could distribute to almost 2 million needy farmers the billions of federal dollars now received by rich agribusiness firms. We could encourage organic commercial farming and phase out the use of pesticides, chemical fertilizers, and livestock hormones. We could engage in a concerted effort at conservation and ecological restoration, including a massive cleanup of the land, air, and water. The most important issue that faces us is the survival of the planet's ecology. If that struggle fails, then everything else we do will be nothing more than rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. We need to develop high-speed mass transit magnetic monorail systems within and between cities for safe, economical, swift transportation. We could develop, and the technology is already there, we could develop electric and solar-powered vehicles to minimize the disastrous ecological effects of the internal combustion engine and fossil fuels. Stanford Ovshinsky, president of Energy Conservation Devices, notes that a newly developed electric car now has a long driving range on a battery that lasts a lifetime. It uses environmentally safe materials and is easily manufactured, with optional costs that are far less than a gas-driven car. But this is the very reason why it's unpopular. The oil companies have no interest in a car that could run so economically and so sanely. And finally, we could phase out nuclear plants, and we could initiate a crash program to develop thermal, hydro, tidal, and solar energy sources. The technology is there, it just needs to be developed. But those who have an interest in developing it have not the power. And those who have the power and the control of it all have no interest in doing that. They've got too much invested in oil and pollution. We could also do other things like institute a single-payer health care system that provides comprehensive service to all and allows patients to go to the doctor of their choice, as does the system in Canada and elsewhere. There's no reason to spend tens of billions more on health care insurance, as President Clinton was planning to do, when we already expend vastly more per capita than any other nation. The funds should go for medical treatment and not to giant insurance companies. Thousands of additional federal inspectors are needed from the various agencies responsible for the enforcement of occupational safety and consumer protection. Where are we going to get the money to pay for all this, one hears. The question is never asked in regard to the defense budget, or the billions spent on business subsidies, or the billions spent on more and more prisons and prison guards. We can get the additional funds from a more progressive tax system and from major cuts in business subsidies and military spending. It's no mystery. The government should stop feeding corporate interests with investment subsidies and other guarantees. Let them experience some of the private enterprise and free market that they're always talking about. And we should redirect these capital investments toward not-for-profit public goals. We need to eliminate the multi-billion dollar welfare handouts to rich corporations and agribusiness. We've got to get the corporations off welfare. Let them try living up to their free market rhetoric. The national debt is a transfer payment from taxpayers to bondholders, from labor to capital, from average people to the wealthy. Like Latin American peasants, U.S. taxpayers will be sacrificing their standard of living for generations to pay off wealthy creditors. The right-wing policy of borrow, borrow, spend, spend ought to be eliminated. The national debt should be rescheduled, with full compensation slated for small treasury bondholders and only partial compensation to larger ones. We could do other things. We could vigorously enforce the law to protect women from male abuse, to protect children from adult abuse, to protect gays and minorities from hate crimes and police brutality. We need stronger federal efforts at fighting the violence perpetrated against abortion clinics and the violence against doctors by the fanatical advocates of compulsory pregnancy. We could initiate a massive federal employment program that would shift our public wealth away from militarism and big corporate profiteering and toward rebuilding the nation. We could have a Works Project Administration, or WPA, like the New Deal was, but more encompassing than the New Deal one. It could employ people to reclaim the environment, build needed industries, affordable housing, and mass transportation systems. It could rebuild a crumbling infrastructure. It could provide services for the aged and the infirm. People could be put to work producing all sorts of goods and services in competition with the private market. But that's why they're not put to work in producing these needed goods and services, because it would be in competition with the private market, and the private corporations do not want anything that cut into their markets. Capital is jealous of any human activity that goes on anywhere, any kind of human productivity in which capital is not accumulating more capital. The New Deal's WPA, for instance, manufactured clothes and mattresses for relief clients. They manufactured surgical gowns for hospitals, canned meats, fruits, and vegetables for the jobless poor. In other words, during the New Deal, a small segment of the federal government went into direct production of goods and services. This kind of not-for-profit direct production to meet human needs brings in revenues to the government, both in the sales of the goods and in the taxes on the incomes of the new jobs created. But eliminated from the picture is private profit for those who live off the labor of others. And this explains their fierce hostility toward government programs that engage in direct production. The government serves and subsidizes corporate interests at public expense. The policy changes listed above would dramatically reverse that flow, producing for human need rather than corporate greed, bringing us away from being a privileged nation for the few and closer to being a democratic republic for the many. Needless to say, these reforms are easier said than done. They remain undone and largely untouched, not because policymakers never thought of them. Rather, it is that those who desire reform have not the power, and those who have the power have not the desire for reform. If anything, they have a furious hostility towards such changes that democratize the economy and infringe upon their capital accumulation. What is needed is greater effort at organizing, educating, and agitating at every point of struggle, be it the workplace, the electoral system, the courts, the media, the college campus, or the streets. And what is needed is greater unity and coalition building for the needs of the people. The struggle for democracy never ends. It's only beginning.
You heard Real Alternatives, the last part of a 12-part series of commentaries by political analyst Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is among the best-informed progressive speakers. He received his Ph.D. in political science from Yale University in 1962 and has taught at colleges in the U.S. and abroad, including State University of New York at Stony Brook and Albany, the University of Vermont, and Sarah Lawrence College. Among the many topics he addresses in his lectures are democracy and economic power, U.S. intervention abroad, the national security state, inventing reality, and the political bias in Hollywood movies, TV, and the press. His books include Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths. For a copy of this talk and one other by Michael Parenti, please send $4 for one cassette and ask for Part 12, Real Alternatives. For the entire 12-part series on 6 cassettes, send $24, that's 6 cassettes for $24, to People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington, 98199, USA. That's People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington, 98199, USA.